Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking with Chip Relay, he's the Senior Research Analyst at Political Research Associates, and he's the author of an essay at publiceye.org, the PRA's website, called Hard Times on the Hard Right, Why Progressives Must Remain Vigilant. Welcome, Chip.
Thank you.
Let's define some of our terms here. What is a right-wing populist, and what is an extreme rightist, et cetera? I mean, what exactly is the domain that you're orienting us towards here?
Well, there's a lot of argument over how to characterize these different groups on the political right. If you start with the Republican Party, that's what we call here mainstream conservatism. And the right wing of the Republican Party would be the Christian right, which is politically active, conservative, Christian evangelicals. A little further out to the right, you have a whole group of people, like in the John Birch Society, who are suspicious that the government is run by secret elites and the government is about to impose tyranny, and it's all part of a gigantic conspiracy. But they really don't step over the line, or at least they seldom step over the line into the kind of overt race hate and overt anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that you find in the extreme right, or the ultra right, which is where you find people in the Ku Klux Klan, people in neo-Nazi groups, Church of the Creator, National Alliance, racist skinheads, groups like that. So my argument is that you need to keep the three major groups on the political right separate, even though you might not like any of them. They really act differently. They sort of keep to themselves. There's a little overlap at the edges, but they're distinct social and political movements.
Would you say that any particular group is more or less prevalent under a conservative administration versus a liberal administration? In other words, would conservative administrations be more likely to bring in and co-opt groups to their immediate right, giving them the impression that if you moved a little bit towards reform and away from extremism, you might be more successful? Or does it work some other way?
No, I think it may well work that way. The trick always is that if you go further out, you'll find people for whom the most conservative administration is still part of the conspiracy. And so when you look on the web today, for instance, you can find a number of really right-wing groups that are on the extreme right or ultra-right who characterize the current administration as too liberal, too selling out to global corporate interests, part of a satanic conspiracy, part of a UN conspiracy, all kinds of things like that. So there's this line where the reform-oriented people can get co-opted, but the more insurgent, more sort of palpably conspiracist groups are never really satisfied.
When did you publish Right-Wing Populism in America?
That was a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. So I presume 9/11 has changed things pretty dramatically, changed the landscape and the Bush administration.
Well, no, I mean, not from the point of view of the book that we wrote, because the book starts in the 1600s and goes to the year 2000. So our argument is that what happens is throughout U.S. history, there are these different dynamics, and at certain periods, right-wing populist groups become quite public and quite large, and you have major social movements and political movements, and then other times they sort of diminish. So that right now, the militia movement is actually having a little internal argument, because originally the militia movement was set up to oppose the government because they thought the government had, you know, basically betrayed America. But after 9/11, some people in the militia movement argued that the government needed to be defended against terrorists, but others stayed in the same old kind of ballywick and argued that the government was still part of the great conspiracy and had to be destroyed. So you certainly have tensions and dynamics that go on, but one thing that you have seen since 9/11 is a tremendous effort on the part of the most conspiracist kinds of groups to argue that the Bush administration was behind the terror attacks.
Well, the Bush administration seems to have given them lots of ammunition, this evidence of prior warnings that were ignored. And, of course, the Bush administration's economic ties to the bin Laden family and to oil interests and so forth.
Well, so there actually is some interesting stuff to look at there. But I think given all of the information that's come out, we certainly need a full investigation. But I really haven't seen any information come out that I think clearly demonstrates that the Bush administration or any government officials really had a clear idea of exactly what was coming and when it was coming. Although you're quite right. I mean, anyone who follows terrorism could have read the articles and reports circulated over the last 3 or 4 years naming bin Laden, naming the rise of kind of a militant fundamentalist form of Islam as a potential threat, and also specifically mentioning the possibility that planes might be used by suicide bombers, which came out of the Philippines. So there's obviously some terrible errors that have been made, but I don't buy into the theories that the Bush administration or, for that matter, the Israeli Mossad was behind the terror attacks.
I wasn't really trying to promote
them. I know. I understand that.
Yeah, but it's just that there's plenty of ammunition. Of course, if you're a conspiracy theorist, there's plenty of ammunition no matter where you look.
Right, exactly. But one of your point's well taken. If the government is overly secretive, if the government is overly authoritarian, and if the government makes these kinds of mistakes, it fuels the most vivid kinds of conspiracy thinking. And so the government really can play a role in either dampening down these suspicions or encouraging them. And I think what we see with 9-1-1 is that what they've done has encouraged conspiracism to a large extent.
Now, on the part of the most extreme far right, there was a welcoming of the 9/11 attacks. There was that famous neo-Nazi email that praised Al-Qaeda's testicular fortitude and wished that American neo-Nazis had the same bravery. Do we see any explicit links? We've seen links, some apparent or maybe fabricated links between American Muslim, black Muslim groups and Al-Qaeda. Are there any links between American white nationalist groups and Al-Qaeda?
This is a very complicated kind of terrain because it's very easy to start to stereotype all of Islam or all Arabs or all people from the Middle East as being part of some gigantic terrorist plot. And I think sometimes the Clash of Civilizations thesis by Huntington leans in that direction, and the people like Stephen Emerson and Daniel Pipes who just, you know, I think step way over the edge. Having said that, there has long been a kind of eerie discourse, a kind of a conversation and trading of information and ideas between some U.S. neo-Nazi groups and some European neo-Nazi groups and some revolutionary groups in the Middle East who have a kind of racial nationalist worldview. And they have a couple of things that bind them together, although they obviously, there's a lot of tension. One is they hate the United States government. Another is that they hate Jews in general, and then we're not talking about just the critique of Israeli state foreign policy, but they hate Jews in a very conspiratorial way. And the third thing is that they believe in racially pure or religiously pure nation states. And so they kind of have this ability to talk about certain issues while maintaining a certain, you know, tension over the fact that in any ideal society that they would build, their coalition partner would be excluded.
Now, we were at a conference together a while back on millennialism, and the millennial, one of the things that was talked at that conference was the millennial idea in Islam and how that may be playing into the rise of Al-Qaeda. Is this something that you've been tracking also, this kind of the parallels or the resonances between Christian millennialism and Islamic millennialism and Jewish millennialism?
Well, I've been looking at apocalypticism for a while, and while I mostly concentrated on apocalyptic thinking in the U.S., I have looked at the fact that if you look at the paradigm, the idea of a coming confrontation between absolute good and absolute evil, which is kind of a final fight for God, in certain militant Islamic groups, this kind of end times fervor, this apocalypticism and their own view of the end times, which includes a confrontation and the return of various historic figures, including Christ, who says you should have been a Muslim, you get this tension building up. And, of course, much of this tension for all three religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, is focused on Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. Now, there's a really, really good book by Gershom Gorenberg about talking about this kind of tension. But if you look at the kind of racial nationalism, religious nationalism, demonization, hatred of liberalism and the Enlightenment in some of the groups like Al-Qaeda and like the Taliban, there's a pretty good argument that can be made that these are kinds of forms of clerical fascism that are in some way similar to, in the U.S., the neo-Nazi Christian identity movement, and historically in Europe, between the two world wars, the rise of certain ethno-nationalist religious fascist groups like the Arrow Cross or the Romanian Iron Guard or the Croatian Ustashi.
One of the points that you make in your essay, Hard Times on the Hard Right, is that progressives have to get past the lumping together of these groups and understand the internal differences, because despite these temporary coalitions or alliances that might be made, as you point out, in the end, usually they are mutually exclusive. Their worldviews are mutually exclusive. And it's always struck me, for instance, that the alliance of a Christian identity movement with neo-Nazis, who often come out of an Odinist, or some kind of pre-Christian religious orientation, if they're religious at all, this is a very bizarre combination, an exploitable weakness.
Absolutely, and in fact, it's ultimately, as you say, irresolvable. These are not worldviews that are somehow complementary. But even on a much more practical level, I mean, one day I might be sitting at a table across the table from someone who's a conservative Christian evangelical who opposes gay rights. But the next week, the two of us might be on the same side of a picket line against neo-Nazi race hate. So, you know, it's complicated, and you really shouldn't burn bridges with some of the groups that might be your ally in another venue without selling out the issues that are important to you. But that requires a more nuanced and complex understanding of the differences in these groups.
I'm speaking with Chip Roulet. He's the senior research analyst at Political Research Associates, and that can be found at publiceye.org. He's been researching the far right in the United States for several decades now. The person who cuts my hair, she's a Catholic conservative, and she was enlightening me the other day about the Catholic conservative perspective on the pedophilia scandal. I don't know if you've heard this theory or not, that it's because of the gay conspiracy that controls Catholic seminaries. Has the prominence of gay rights and homosexual organizations given a new form of conspiratorial thinking, a new enemy in the conspiratorial pantheon to these far-right groups?
Sure, and that happens historically as well. In any given historic period, when you have these kinds of right-wing populist movements that are very suspicious of the government and very suspicious of what they would consider parasites in the body politic, they basically are always railing against these secret elites up above. But then who they target are people who actually are lower on the social or economic scale. And so, you know, you can attack, if you don't like the British, you can go after Indians in the United States if you're in the colonies. You can go after witches in Salem. You can attack Catholics and sack a convent here outside of Boston in the middle of the 1800s. You can demonize Italian immigrants and Russian immigrants and anarchists and Bolsheviks in the Palmer Raids, 1919, 1920. It's Reds in the 50s. Communist conspiracy was supposedly behind Martin Luther King Jr. in the 60s and 70s, and then you had the feminazis and the gay plague. So these scapegoats, these demonized scapegoats, are woven into conspiracy theories throughout history. And very recently, about 10-some-odd years ago, you saw a series of books come out claiming that there was this homosexual network. That was actually the name of one of the earliest books, even longer ago, put out under the auspices of the Free Congress Foundation. And ever since then, you've had these conspiracy theories about how different gay groups, basically homosexuals, men, are somehow controlling the government or controlling the media or controlling seminaries or, you know, trying to put teachers into schools to molest your children, even though, you know, all of the hospital administrators will tell you that child molesters are mostly family members who are ostensibly heterosexual.
One of the trends that you've been pointing to and other researchers on the far right that seemed very worrisome was the European third wave, the effort to craft a new far-right set of ideologies which could bridge some of the ideological gaps and differences between the different kinds of national groups. Can you tell us a little bit about the third wave and where is it right now with the rise of Le Pen and everything else?
Right. This was an attempt to argue for a kind of softer, gentler racial nationalism or ethno-nationalism. And one of the key themes of it is that it was critical of both communism and global capitalism. It offered an alternative in that sense, so thus third way or third wave or third position. There are other groups that call themselves the third way or third position that aren't neo-Nazis, but we're talking about a kind of soft racial nationalist ethno-nationalist belief structure that in France was led by Le Pen, but the intellectual leader of it was a man named Alain de Benoist, who argued that every country should have its own distinctive racial culture, but it should be respectful of other cultures. And now he's changed his view slightly to be more cultural, but you see it with Jörgi Haider in Austria. You see it in other countries where there have been elections based on a very virulent anti-immigrant, anti-foreigner, and essentially from Europe, anti-people of color kind of constituency. And you see this spreading around the world, and you also see it in Africa in certain conflicts between different national groups and ethno-national groups. You see it currently in India, where you have Hindu nationalists trying to suppress the Muslims. So this is a very important new kind of political thinking. And, you know, this new book by Carol Swain talks about this with the new white nationalism in the U.S. I disagree with her prescription for how to deal with it, which seems to me to be rolling back a lot of the gains that, you know, people of color have made. But I think she's right to say that this is a new kind of packaging of racial nationalism that appears, at least on the surface, to be much less virulent and much more something that needs to be debated openly. And I would agree with her with that. I don't like the new white nationalism, but I think it is something that's different from neo-Nazism. And it is a form of right-wing populism, in my view.
My own thinking about racial nationalism was strongly influenced by the fact that I went to Sri Lanka in 1983 to work there for a while, and immediately the country went into civil war that continues today. And part of the cause of the civil war was the fact that the left, the post-colonial left, which was very strong in Sri Lanka, Trotskyist, socialist, communist left, made a tactical alliance for many years with the Sinhala nationalist movement in the belief that they could ride Sinhala nationalism as a progressive form of nationalism and anti-imperialism. And the consequence was that it led to 20 years of civil war and many hundreds of thousands dead. Do you, looking at these various kinds of nationalisms around the world and thinking about the current stage of history, do you have an opinion on the historic debate on the left about the idea of progressive nationalism? Is there such a thing as progressive nationalism, or do all racial national identities, when politically mobilized, lead to regressive consequences?
It's a really complicated question, and I'm going to duck it a little, but I'll talk about it because Nikhil Aziz and I worked together here in this office, and we wrote a big piece on nationalism and sort of theories of ethno-nationalism. And it's a problem because in some circumstances it appears to be a good idea in situations where nations want to throw off some kind of colonial power. It appears on the surface that it's a good idea to form a coalition with some nationalist groups. But in the long run, it appears that this can often go bad very hideously. And certainly you have that even with Gandhi, who very carefully thought about working with nationalist groups, and he decided to do it. And one of the arguments today, of course, is that that decision, which seems to have made perfect sense, you know, decades ago, now is echoing back or blowing back in the form of the BJP party and other Hindu ethno-nationalist groups in India. So my answer is, I think we need to look at this a lot more carefully. I will admit to being highly skeptical that this is something that is a good idea just unilaterally. I suspect that there are some serious problems with this theory about riding the wave of nationalism for national liberation against colonialism. But certainly in the modern world, when that kind of colonialism has vanished, the idea of somehow fighting, and this is the new theory, we're going to fight global corporate rule, this kind of globalization on behalf of corporations, by beefing up our nationalisms, as our nation states will have a resurgence of nationalism and sovereignty, which will keep these corporate predators at bay. And I'm very suspicious that once you open up the Pandora's box of nationalism, it's not so easy to close. And if there's economic or social stress on the society that has unleashed some form of ethno or racial or religious nationalism, that very quickly this can become a kind of purge mentality where there are certain people considered to be the appropriate citizens and everyone else has to be suppressed in some way.
You know, I'm far from saying that the anti-globalization movement is crypto-racist, but anti-globalization activists, by and large, that I have met in the United States are blissfully ignorant, in my opinion, of precisely what you pointed out, of the fact that, you know, that they need to be pointing towards a globally integrated political alternative that is something other than national revanchism and isolationism. And very few of them ever have presented that alternative in any systematic way.
No, it's a little creepy because you would hope that the history of ethno-nationalism would be fairly clear given the results of the Armenian genocide, the Nazi genocide of Jews, the genocide in Rwanda, the genocides that, you know, are waiting to happen with ethno-religious or racial nationalist formations going berserk. So I very much agree that the globalization activists who, anti-globalization activists very much need to study the history of what happens when nationalism runs amok and be a little skeptical of the idea that we should be working with people like Pat Buchanan.
One of the studies that I read of yours way back, maybe 25 years ago, I think, was a study of the LaRouche movement, and it came in handy because, as I told you earlier, my first college advisor was a member of this LaRouche cult. And one of the things that I always liked about the LaRouche movement, if one can like something about it, is that it came out of of Marxist background, and there was a kind of twisted logic to the early LaRouche idea that Marx thought that capitalists were progressive and at a certain point in history and would win out over the aristocrats, and Marx and LaRouche basically concluded in his twisted Trotskyist way that the capitalists had never won, and therefore you had to, that all progressives should unite with the capitalists against the remnants of the aristocracy. Then they went in some other direction entirely, I understand, but whatever happened to Lyndon LaRouche, and are they still around? Are they still part of the problem?
Well, they're still around, and I think they're still part of the problem. I mean, what they did is that with that very analysis that you've just laid out, they decided that Rockefeller family, as the aristocratic family of America in their mind, had to be crushed. And they were willing to work with anyone to crush the Rockefellers. And when they looked around for allies, they discovered that there was a whole nother group of people in the United States who also wanted to crush the secret elites like the Rockefellers. And it turned out to be two groups. It turned out to be the right-wing populists like in the John Birch Society, but it also turned out to be raging anti-Semites who thought the Rockefellers were secretly doing the bidding of the Jews. And in short order, in a matter of a few years, Lyndon LaRouche had discovered the grand right-wing conspiracies of the Freemasons and the Illuminati and the Venetians, whatevers, and the Black Gulf nobility, and of course, the Rothschild family, a historic anti-Semitic conspiracy theory about Jewish banking. And so he pretty much switched to the right and began to promulgate these amazing anti-elite conspiracy theories. But he was very clever because he's a very smart man, as well as being something of a crackpot and a crook who's a convicted felon. But he argued that the left and right, you know, should really, again, still be focusing against this aristocracy, but weaving in conspiracy theories in a way that it was very difficult to see the historic right-wing roots. he didn't talk about Jewish banking. He talked about very obscure movements in which just happened to be made up of people which he, you know, later identified as Jews. So it was a hidden kind of cloaked conspiracism which was attractive to a lot of people on the left for a while until it became obvious where he was going. Now he tends to attract people who just want to rail against the secret elites, and he really continues. He came out of jail for tax fraud and securities fraud, and continued to run for president. And now he's working with some people in the Nation of Islam around the theory that groups like the Anti-Defamation League helped start the Ku Klux Klan, not, and basically arguing this continued cloaked kind of anti-Jewish conspiracy theory that tracks back 100 years.
Well, you say in the essay "Hard Times on the Right," the hard right, that the militias and the similar far-right groups have fallen on hard times.
Well, specifically, I say the militias have fallen on hard times, but not the larger movement they came out of. My argument is that there has been, you know, and this goes back to the book Matt Lyons that I wrote. We argue that there are right-wing populist movements that historically appear in the U.S., and that the current big one that started, you know, pretty much post-World War II, called itself the Patriot Movement, or the Americanist movement, or whatever, and that after the Gulf War and the government misconduct and real abuse of power against the Weaver family in Ruby Ridge, Idaho, and the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas, the Patriot Movement spun off an armed militia movement. Now, the armed militia movement grew even after the Oklahoma City bombing and didn't really start to collapse until about 1998, and now it's really a shadow of its former self. But I don't think the Patriot Movement has disappeared, and you can still see the John Birch Society people out there selling their magazine, and there are all sorts of websites that are patriot-oriented, websites like the Free Republic website. So I don't think that large sector has vanished, but I do think the militia movement has largely collapsed.
We're almost out of time, but tell us in a nutshell, there have been groups on the hard left for a long time who go out and bash heads with neo-Nazis whenever they march. What do you think is the most effective strategy for progressives to battle the far right?
Well, I think you need a combination of strategies. I think you need to work with... I think it's important to hold educational seminars. I think it's important every time there's any kind of hate incident for people in leadership positions to stand up and oppose it. I also think there's some creative strategies like, you know, pledging $5 for every 10 minutes a Nazi rally goes on to some local, you know, anti-racism group, so that the longer the rally goes on, the more money is raised to fight racism. And I think sometimes it is important to be face-to-face and to confront and yell at the folks who stage these rallies. But I don't believe in attacking the rallies or attacking the police. But I think there are times when it's important for people to face these race haters in the street face-to-face and yell at them, because they deserve to be yelled at. What I don't approve of is when you decide to rush the stage or beat up some cop who's just trying to, you know, do their job. I think that is a kind of silly adolescent rage that doesn't go anywhere. But there are people who should be there to confront them, because otherwise there is an audience that might be there that is just listening and doesn't know where to turn.
I've been speaking with Chip Relay. He's the Senior Research Associate for Political Research Associates, and they can be found at publiceye.org. The essay "Hard Times on the Hard Right" is there, as well as links to your book, which is Right-Wing Populism in America. And thanks for being with us today, Chip.
Oh, really? Thanks for a good conversation.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.